You're listening to The Star Spot, episode 60, for Sunday, September 7th, 2014.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at @thestarspot. Just like the cities of our world, galaxies are the busy and overcrowded population centers where so much of the action takes place in our universe. The study of globular clusters and starburst galaxies are providing new insights into how these cities of the cosmos were built. To share with us new discoveries from the Spitzer Space Telescope, including gossip about the weird behavior of our next-door metropolis, the Andromeda Galaxy, today I'm joined at the Star Spot by Pauline Barmby. But first, here's what's current in space.
Following last month's Starspot report of recent developments in lunar news about the now openly considered intentions of nations outside the U.S. to lead their own manned lunar missions, Space.com announced today that China expects to launch a recoverable moon orbiter prototype this year. The nation has been actively working towards an ambitious lunar exploration program. Their goal? To robotically land a probe on the moon and return moon samples back to Earth. The sample return mission, called Chang'e 5, is expected to be running by 2017, and the test orbiter to be launched by the end of this year would represent China's first attempt at returning a lunar probe to Earth. In preparation for its lunar launch, the experimental recoverable moon orbiter arrived recently at the Zichang Satellite Launch Center in the southern province of Sichuan. Designed specifically to inspect the technology and foundational infrastructure for their subsequent sample return mission in 2017, it also features high-speed re-entry hardware that would be able to more readily take the heat from the Earth's atmosphere and then land. China delivered its first land rover on the lunar surface in 2013, with Chang'e 3, and now with new changes to that moon orbiter model, China would be able to check out the hardware needed for the Chang'e 5 mission. Reports from China's Xinhua News Agency indicate that the orbiter is planned to be launched into lunar orbit and then return to Earth at an escape velocity of 11.2 kilometers per second. China's new sample return mission would produce a number of technological breakthroughs, and according to Chinese space officials, they include those pertaining to sampling encapsulation, lunar surface takeoff, rendezvous and docking in the lunar orbit, as well as high-speed Earth re-entry. And in addition to an ultimate goal of putting a human on the moon, China has been working on the construction of a lunar base, which they expect to use for new energy development and living space expansion. This may not happen at least until the mid-2020s or later, but they are now scoping out precisely what they would achieve. Leading manned missions to the moon may no longer be an American goal, and shortly after he assumed office, President Obama did cancel a NASA manned mission, the Constellation Return to the Moon program. Going to the moon for other nations, however, has become a goal to significantly contribute to their national prestige. They include China, Russia, India, and Iran, with Japan talking about sending a humanoid robot to the moon. After all, the moon is only 3 days away from the Earth's surface. But though lunar probes have been sent by NASA since 1972, Today, the agency is much more interested in the prospect of visiting other planets in our solar system, namely Mars. In the meantime, a senior advisor of the China Academy of Space Technology, Ye Pijian, feels it's important to state that China started late in the space race. And while they have not yet produced manned lunar missions, they do have substantial technology for these missions, and that a study and move to possible manned lunar missions would be considered after their probes return to Earth successfully.
And that's what's current in space. Pauline Barmby is an observational astrophysicist and associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Western Ontario. She worked at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, and is a member of the instrument team for IRAC, the infrared array camera on the Spitzer Space Telescope. In her spare time, Dr. Barmby gives public talks clarifying misconceptions about astronomy. She is a science fiction enthusiast and enjoys listening to podcasts, hopefully including the Star Spot. I'm very pleased to be joined here at the Star Spot by Professor Pauline Barmby. Thanks for joining me.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
I want to ask you straight off a very, I suppose, general question before we talk specific galaxies. You talk a lot on your website, on your biography. Your interest is in galaxy formation, how galaxies end up the way they do. Can you tell me what are some of the most important factors in terms of the evolution of a galaxy, on in terms of just the broad strokes?
Well, when we look around us at galaxies in the nearby universe, we can see that they come in a bunch of different shapes. So we have large spiral galaxies like our own Milky Way. We have big elliptical galaxies, which are different in that they tend to have a different arrangement of stars and less gas. We see little dwarf galaxies, which are often quite irregular. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do in my research is try to figure out what causes a galaxy to end up one way or the other. And we know that one of the things that's really important is where a galaxy lives. So if it's in an environment where it's near a lot of other galaxies, it's probably going to interact with those galaxies, and that can result in increasing the amount of star formation, for example. Depending on the nature of the interaction, it can also tear a galaxy apart. So we know that, that's one important factor. We think another thing that's important in how galaxies end up the way they do is the interaction between the galaxy and its central black hole. We know that central black holes in galaxies they know about the galaxies around them, in that there is a relationship between how big the black hole is and how big the central bulge of the galaxy is. And we know that central black holes can also affect the galaxies in that they can blow out these huge jets, which in some circumstances seem to enhance star formation and in other circumstances seem to shut it off. So environment is one big thing. The presence of a central black hole is another big thing. And some people have suggested that one of the most important things in how a galaxy ends up is something very simple. It's the amount of angular momentum, how much spin the giant gas cloud that becomes a galaxy starts with. And if you have a very highly spinning gas cloud, then you end up with something that looks like a spiral galaxy. And if you have a initial galaxy with less spin, you end up with something that looks more like an elliptical galaxy, for example.
One of the areas of particular interest for you in terms of answering the question with respect to galaxy formation is looking at star clusters. And I'm wondering if you can explain to me the connection there. How does studying star clusters help us to understand galaxy formation?
Right, that's a great question. So what star clusters are typically very tightly bound together groups of stars between sort of 1,000 and a couple of million stars. And they have a couple of advantages. If you want to look at the history of what's gone on in a galaxy, one thing that you can do is look at the ages of the stars in the galaxy. So if you see that that galaxy has a lot of young stars, that means that it must have had some star formation that happened recently. If you see that it has a bunch of stars of a particular age, that tells you something interesting must have happened to the galaxy at that age. So, okay, what does that have to do with star clusters? Well, star clusters tend to be, in addition to being very tightly bound together in space, they're also tightly bound together in age and in composition, in that all the stars in a cluster are basically the same age and the same composition. And so, but because you have 10,000 stars or a million stars in the same place, they're much brighter than an individual star. And so if you want to trace the history of a galaxy, you want to know, when did it have a lot of star formation or when were things pretty quiet? One of the things that you can do is look at the ages of the star clusters. Look at where the star clusters are in the galaxy and are they related to the ages, for example, or to the composition. And that tells you about the history of the galaxy in a way that you might not be able to tell from individual stars just because the star clusters are so much brighter when you put them all together.
Gotcha. And of course, one of the galaxies that you're studying with a lot of intensity is Andromeda, is the closest large galaxy to the Milky Way, also known as M31. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about Andromeda and your work on it, but you're using something called the Spitzer Space Telescope. And I don't think we've talked a lot about the Spitzer Space Telescope here at the Star Spot. Tell me firstly, what's Spitzer all about?
Okay. So Spitzer is like the Hubble Space Telescope, which most people have heard of, in that it's a telescope in space. The big difference, however, is that it works at longer infrared wavelengths. So whereas the Hubble telescope detects light that we can see with our eyes for the most part, the Spitzer telescope is detecting light with longer wavelengths between about 3 microns, so that would be 3,000 nanometers, and about 160 microns. So it's detecting radiation mostly from things that are cooler than stars, from gas and dust and forming stars in nearby galaxies and in very distant galaxies.
And when you use Spitzer and other optical telescopes to look at M31, to look at Andromeda, tell me what kind of features you're able to discern. I've always kind of wondered this in terms of the state of the art of our technology right now. When we're looking at galaxies other than the Milky Way, say the closest galaxies like Andromeda, what are some of the smallest features that we can observe and study of a galaxy like Andromeda?
Right. So the smallest feature that you can observe and study depends on the resolution of your telescope, so how fine detail it can see. And that resolution depends on two things. It depends on the wavelength of light that you're using. So there's better resolution. You can see more detail if you're looking at smaller wavelengths of light, like the visible light or ultraviolet light. And then the other thing that resolution depends on is how big your telescope is. So a bigger telescope gives you better resolution. So as an example, the Hubble Space Telescope can see things with a fine detail of about 0.1 arc seconds. And in the Andromeda Galaxy, that corresponds to a distance of something like 1 light year. So we can see structures on the size scale of about a light year in the Andromeda Galaxy. If you put two stars a light year apart, we can almost distinguish them as two point sources instead of one blurry source. With the Spitzer telescope, the resolution is not quite as good as the Hubble. For one thing, it's a smaller telescope. It's actually only 85 centimeters in diameter, and it also uses longer infrared wavelengths, so that also makes the resolution not quite so good. So it has a resolution of about 1.5 arc seconds, which corresponds to something like about 6 parsecs, which would be about 2 light years.
What kind of features with Andromeda were you in particular interested in? Was it again star clusters?
I've done a lot of work on various aspects of Andromeda. And so one of the things that I did with Spitzer was to actually make a map of the entire galaxy in the infrared wavelengths that we can see with Spitzer. And you might think, well, you know, isn't that something people had done before? It turns out it wasn't, and that's because the galaxy, because it's near, quite nearby, is quite large on the sky. It takes up a big fraction of a big piece of sky, such that if you could see it with your eyes, it would be bigger than the full moon. And so in order to make an infrared map with the fairly small infrared detectors that we have, you actually have to take many hundreds of different pictures and then sort of stitch them together. Not with Photoshop, but the same kind of idea. And so what you get when you do that kind of big picture map is you get a picture of where all of the stars are in the galaxy, how they're distributed. You get a good picture of where the dust is in the galaxy and how that's distributed. And you get that in a way that you can't get from, say, a Hubble picture, because with a Hubble picture, for example, the dust in the galaxy itself means that you can't see through and see all the stars. The dust absorbs some of the starlight. And so one of the things we could do with a Spitzer image is actually, for example, to measure the whole mass of the galaxy as far as mass is related to the amount of emitting stars. And we could measure the star formation rate of the whole galaxy by looking at how much dust there is.
And I believe you were actually part of a group that was able to confirm the population of stars in the Andromeda galaxy through a second method to provide, you know, reassurance that we were in the right ballpark with an estimate of, I think, a trillion stars or something like that. And I'm wondering how that compares to the Milky Way. That's quite a bit bigger than our galaxy, isn't it?
It is. And the question of whether Andromeda and the Milky Way are sort of sisters or cousins, and which one is bigger and which one is smaller, people have gone back and forth on that a lot over the past 20, 30, 40 years. For a while, it was thought that the Milky Way was definitely bigger. Then it became a little bit smaller. And some of that has to actually do with something very simple, in that you to know these kinds of things, to know how big Andromeda is, you have to really accurately know the distance to the galaxy. And so if you put the galaxy closer or further away, that actually changes your estimate of how massive it is by quite a bit.
Gotcha. In terms of the events that determined Andromeda's formation and evolution, as you were studying star clusters and other features of Andromeda, what were some of the major events during Andromeda's life so far?
Right. Well, one of the things that you can see when you look, not necessarily at the star clusters, but at the galaxy as a whole, is you can see that the spiral structure of Andromeda seems to have kind of a disturbance in it at one point. So Andromeda, the galaxy of Andromeda, is a flat disk, but it's actually tilted with respect to our line of sight. So we're not looking down upon the disk as if we were looking from above. We're actually looking at it from an angle, which makes it a little tricky to see exactly where the spiral arms are. But what appears to be the case when we look at it is that there's a kind of a hole punched through one of the spiral arms. And we think that might have been due to one of its little companion galaxies actually punching through the disk of Andromeda at some point in the not so recent past, something like 200 million years ago. So that would be a relatively recent event. What we can also see when we look at the star clusters in Andromeda is that since that 200 million years ago, there doesn't appear to have been a whole lot going on. It's a relatively quiet galaxy, which is not forming a lot of new stars. And in fact, its rate of making new stars compared to the Milky Way is quite a bit lower.
When we look at some of these pivotal events that have happened to particular galaxies, like you're describing for Andromeda, or things that we've learned about our own galaxy, how much can we generalize to the way a typical galaxy, let's say in the nearby universe, behaves and how it evolved during its life?
Right. So, you know, are we studying this one galaxy and drawing conclusions which might not be applicable to the broad set of galaxies? I would say that for looking at Andromeda and the Milky Way, they're actually in what I think most people would consider a fairly typical galaxy environment, in that they're in kind of a small group, a couple of big galaxies, a whole bunch of little galaxies, and they're not, for example, at the center of a giant galaxy cluster, which is a very exciting place, but also not a very common place for galaxies to be. So I think that the broad strokes of what happened to Andromeda and the Milky Way in the past should be generally applicable to lots of galaxies. You're certainly right, though, that exactly what happened to these galaxies is not going to be exactly what happened to every other galaxy.
One of the classes or categories of star clusters that I know you've been focusing on as well are something called globular clusters. And this is like Spitzer. It's a bit of a new concept for the star spot. So tell me what defines a globular cluster as a category of a star cluster.
Okay. So the word globular actually just means that it's round. And so if you look at one of these things in a telescope, they look quite round. They look like a ball of stars. The stars are packed together more closely at the center. So if you look through a telescope, what you see is kind of a bright central circular thing. With as you go towards the edges of the circular thing, you can see that instead of being just uniformly bright, it kind of breaks up into individual stars. So our galaxy itself has about 150 of these globular clusters. They've been known for a long time. They're relatively easy to see with a small telescope. And they tend to be quite old in that they tend to be, say, more than 8 billion years old, more than 8 gigayears old. And some of them, in fact, appear to be as old as the universe. And for a while, there was a problem that they seem to actually be older than the universe, which does not indicate that they are the remnants of some previous universe or something. It just means that our methods of figuring out how old things were did not agree.
Right. And so how was that finally reconciled out of curiosity? I guess one or the other had to change its age. Was it the universe?
Actually, both things changed. So the way that you estimate how old a star cluster is you look at how massive the most massive stars that are just ending their lives are, and you assume that that's the age of the star cluster. So if the most massive star that's ending its life is about the same as the mass of the sun, and you from your models of stars, you know that stars with the mass of the sun live 10 billion years, then you infer that the mass of the star cluster's age is also 10 billion years. And so those models have changed a little bit over the past 20 years as people figure out exactly what properties of stars have to be included. And then, yeah, the age of the universe has also changed a little bit as we figure out exactly how fast it's expanding and what it contains, such that we can trace the expansion back and figure out what the age was when the expansion started.
Gotcha. From what you've studied and what others have studied, where are globular clusters typically found in a galaxy?
They tend to be found mostly around the outskirts of galaxies. So you can think of them as kind of satellites of galaxies.
Okay. Sort of in the halo region of a galaxy, typically?
Mostly in the halo. Some of them are found near the central bulges of the galaxies as well, but they are not found, for example, in our own Milky Way, globular clusters are mostly not found within the disk, the region where the young stars are.
And in terms, again, of generalizing what we've been seeing from Andromeda or from the Milky Way to the local cluster of galaxies, is it fair to say most galaxies in the local group have similar numbers of globular clusters? What was it, about 150 or so?
Actually, the Milky Way has about 150. Andromeda has something more like 450 or 500. And so for people who like star clusters, it's really a gold mine because you have a lot more clusters there to study. And the reason why those two numbers are so different is actually not something that we currently quite understand. And it's something that people are trying to figure out.
Does it tend to scale with the size of the galaxy, Andromeda being somewhat bigger in terms of total stars?
Yeah, it does scale with the size of the galaxy. So little tiny galaxies like the Magellanic Clouds, which are satellites of the Milky Way, they have a few globular clusters each, where a few means you can count them on two hands. And big, humongous galaxies like M87, the giant galaxy at the middle of the Virgo cluster, it has 10,000 globular clusters. So they do scale with size of galaxy to some extent, but most people, I think, would not claim that Andromeda has, for example, three times the mass of the Milky Way, yet it does seem to have three times as many globular clusters.
Gotcha. And again, in terms of looking at that connection between clusters, globular or stellar clusters, and the formation and evolution of galaxies, you mentioned that globular clusters seem to be extremely old. They're in the halo. What is the suggestion in terms of the role they would have played in galaxy formation and perhaps evolution?
Well, when people who are studying star formation in our own Milky Way look around to see where stars are being formed, they tend to find that a lot of stars are being formed in stellar clusters, right? Stars tend not to be formed all by themselves. And so the suggestion has been put forth that, in fact, that's kind of a rule, that all stars form in clusters. And what we see when we look at old star clusters is just kind of the remnants of that population. The few star clusters that were able to use their own gravity to hold themselves together against the galaxy trying to pull them apart, basically. And so what they give us is a snapshot of what a bunch of stars that are 10 billion years old looks like. There are lots of other stars that are also 10 billion years old in a galaxy, but it's a lot harder to pick them out if you have to kind of search for them one by one, whereas if they're all together in a star cluster, that makes life a little bit easier.
I want to ask you about one particularly odd galaxy, Centaurus A, Sen A, I think it's called.
Yep.
And I saw on your website that you have a student who's working on this, and I hadn't heard much about Centaurus A before, so I read a bit about it, and it is very, very odd.
Yep.
But tell me why it's so odd.
So the first thing to know about Centaurus A is the name. And when you hear a name like constellation in a letter, like Centaurus A or Circinus A or something like that, it usually means that an object is a radio source. And that comes from the early days of radio astronomy, where you couldn't know very well where the radio waves were coming from. All you could do was figure out that they were coming from a constellation. So Centaurus A is the brightest source of radio waves in the constellation of Centaurus. And it was later figured out that it's associated with this galaxy, which has an unassuming name of NGC 5128. But when you look at this galaxy, it's actually quite unusual. It looks mostly like an elliptical galaxy, so it's got a smooth distribution of starlight. But right across the middle, it's got a dark lane of dust, which is something that you would see normally in a spiral galaxy. And it's a very bright radio source, because when you look at it with higher resolution radio telescope, what you see is that it's got these enormous jets coming out from it, which are the source of the radio emission. And so what people think is probably going on with this galaxy is that it's the result of an elliptical galaxy which has merged with a smaller galaxy, maybe a spiral, maybe a regular galaxy. That smaller galaxy brought in the stuff that became the dust lane, and that merger triggered the black hole in this galaxy to get very excited and spew out all these jets, which produce this radio energy. So what I'm trying to do with this particular galaxy is figure out what has kind of happened to that material brought in by the smaller galaxy that's merged in. There seems to be some evidence that there's new stars forming in that material. And what my student and I were trying to do was map out the regions where new stars were forming and to try to figure out what, for example, the distribution of the heavy elements in those stars might be in those star-forming regions.
So these often elliptical galaxies that are seen in this period of intense star formation, I think what they call a starburst galaxy, could these ellipticals themselves be the result of prior mergers? Often ellipticals are created by two spirals merging. Is that not true?
That is a general picture that people often have, yes, that's where ellipticals come from, that you merge two smaller galaxies, you get a big pile of star formation, and then everything kind of settles down and you have an old, boring galaxy. So what we think that NGC 5128 might be is an example of this happening not in the far distant past, but in the relatively recent past, and that's why things haven't totally settled down yet.
Gotcha. Now, taking lessons from what you've been learning from your studies about star formation and how they inform the evolution of galaxies, can we draw any characteristics or any, let's say, any differences between what happens in the nearby universe and the local cluster as compared to some of the more distant galaxies that, of course, we see them as they were many millions or billions of years ago. But are there commonalities or are there significant differences in star formation and galaxy formation between those two categories of galaxies?
Right. So when we look at distant galaxies, one of the things that we can see is that they tend to be less regular in their shape. So you're much more likely to see a galaxy which is kind of blobby and irregular if you look at a very distant galaxy. And if you look at how fast galaxies are forming stars, that star formation rate on average has been higher in the past. So galaxies were forming more stars in the past than they are now. There are certainly some commonalities in that we see differences, for example, in galaxies in different environments, both in the past and today. But one of the things that we can't figure out with distant galaxies, because they're so far away, we typically only get the view of the galaxy as a whole. We can't see necessarily whether stars are forming all over the galaxy or in a few specific pockets, or under what conditions we get new star formation. And that's one of the big pluses of looking at nearby galaxies, is you get not only the big picture of the whole galaxy, which is quite hard to get in our own Milky Way, for example, because we can't really see the whole Milky Way, we're inside it. But in nearby galaxies, you can get that big picture and you can get that detail of, well, here's what's happening over here and here's what's happening over here in a different place.
Gotcha. I wanted to switch gears to something quite different. You were reassuring citizens of your city, London, Ontario, that they would be surviving the December 2012 period, despite Mayan prophecies supposedly predicting the apocalypse. And I think you and your colleague jointly participated in a debunking event, debunking these kinds of pseudoscientific myths, which is something that I dabble in as well. So I was quite intrigued to read about that. And I just want to ask you, why was it important, do you think, for you and other of your scientific colleagues, your physics and astronomy colleagues in particular, to get involved in kind of a public engagement with pseudoscience in particular?
Well, I think that the most important thing that we get to do as scientists is we have the luxury of being able to sit around and think about the broader universe, think about what's outside our own little boundaries of life and even our own little planet. And lots of people don't have that luxury. And so when they hear something that says that a giant rogue asteroid is going to hit the Earth or something like that, they just don't have the experience or the judgment to know whether that's a reasonable thing that they should be afraid of, or just some kind of nonsense. And, you know, given that we're in this privileged position of being able to think about the universe, I think it's incumbent upon us to share what we know with other people and tell them that, hey, look, this is something that's exciting. And, you know, this, maybe you should be a little bit concerned about space rocks hitting the Earth. Let's think about the Chelyabinsk meteorite, for example. But here's this other information that's totally crazy and you shouldn't be worried about it. So, you know, we have that knowledge. And I think the public funds us to do our research and to do our teaching. And it's only fair that we share that with other people.
No, that's a fair point that, you know, your average person is going to hear so much about potential catastrophes, death from above, asteroids versus the galactic alignment, according to the Mayans, apparently.
Right.
You know, how do you distinguish between what you're being told from one source versus another? Is this kind of thing something that you've been doing more of, perhaps before or since this event last year that you participated in?
Until a year or two ago, I sort of taught a large first year astronomy course. And so that's something that you tend to do a lot of in that kind of course, because you tend to get students who don't have very much background in the area and they want to know more. And so I try to convince them that, you know, there are some information sources that are reliable and some that are not so reliable. There haven't been, as far as I know, too many recent predictions of the world ending, which makes me happy. So I haven't been fighting that particular battle recently, but I certainly do my best to talk to people about astronomy if they're interested and do public talks and things like that.
Professor Pauline Barmby, it's awfully good of you to join us here at the Star Spot, where we hope it's a reliable source of information.
And we hope that the universe will last beyond December 21st of this year.
Indeed. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li. Marketing and promotions by Natalie Morkos. Guest hosting by Denise Fong. News production by Benjamin Jenkins. News contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carminas Villens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.